evening. You're watching Stockwatch with myself, Nastasia Arensa. Tackling your questions in studio tonight is Jean-Pierre Verster from Protea Capital Management and Rikus Riedus from PSG Wealth Sandton. Don't forget to send through your questions to us via SMS to 41392, email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za or tweet us at BusinessDayTV using the hashtag Stockwatch. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Rikus, let's start off with you. What did you make of today's market's performance?
It was terrible in one word. I don't think there was any place to hide except maybe for gold counters. But the release of our jobs data just put an absolute rocket on the way down, unfortunately, in most counters. And I think it was just general misery as far as I could see.
Jean-Pierre, Nyusa caught your attention. I mean, he mentioned the unemployment figures. I'm sure there was anything else. Eskom, perhaps?
Yes, Eskom is something that I think is giving us all some nightmares if you think about the quantum of debt and the difficult situation they are.
Yeah.
So, yes, the SOEs in general, what's going to happen is a big problem for the country and the fiscus. But generally today, a lot of red on the screen, so my shorts are better than my longs, that's for sure. You don't get a lot of days when that happens, but today was one of those days. Just a little bit of news, just JSE that came out with some results.
Yeah.
They're under pressure with less foreign investments into the country, less people trading on the JSE. Mm. It means that their revenue was under pressure. And the long-standing CEO also saying that she will retire. She's still young, so we'll need to wait and see what she does next.
Yeah.
But a good replacement announced as well. So that was the news that piqued my interest today.
Speaking of CEOs, then you had Old Mutual and the High Court's decision saying that he should be reinstated. And the first thing he said, he'll be there first thing at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. But there is still, I suppose, a part B to, you know, his court application saying that he wants the chairman and the 12 non-executive directors declared delinquent. What do you make of the whole Old Mutual thing at this point? I mean, we don't have the full information at this stage. But from your perspective?
I think what you said there is key. We don't have the full information. Okay, so we've got that legal process sorted, but it doesn't change what the facts might or might not be. I don't really have a strong feeling, except that it's a pity that it's happening, because I don't think fundamentally there's anything wrong with Old Mutual, but this is putting pressure on the share price in a market like we have.
Yeah.
That kind of pressure isn't needed.
Let's take things globally a little bit. We've got China trade talks that have somewhat informally resumed today. There was a dinner taking place at one of the hotels, and they will formally take place, you know, at some point during the week. And I read a news article saying this is the 12th time that they are meeting. So when you look at your levels of either optimism or perhaps even a little bit of doubt, where do you think talks might go at this point?
Well, reading through the commentary, and remember this is the first time since May that they've actually met, apart from the G20 meeting where Trump and Xi Jinping had a sort of informal meeting. And Trump himself saying that he doesn't think that there's going to be a heck of a lot happening. I think the surprise would be if something happens, but at least they're talking.
Jean-Pierre, your view?
So instead of trying to think what will be the outcome and will therefore, will it be good or bad for stocks, what I prefer to do is to say what stocks that are affected by the trade tensions and it's already in the price.
Yeah.
Meaning that even if we have a bad outcome, those prices might not fall a lot, but if we have a good outcome, the prices could rise quite significantly, called an asymmetrical payoff profile. And when I look at, for instance, at the global chip companies, the semiconductor companies, there are a few companies that are so cheap, their share prices have come so far down because people are so bearish, thinking that they won't be able to sell their microchips into China, that those shares are very cheap.
Yeah.
So even if we have a bad outcome and it isn't resolved and there's still tariffs, the prices shouldn't go much lower. Mm. Famous last word, shouldn't. But there's also the chance of the share prices gaining a lot of value if we do get a resolution and the trading between Huawei and some other chip manufacturers are easier to do going forward. So those are the specific opportunities that I look for rather than forecast what will be the outcome of the trade talks themselves.
All right. Before we get to the question, Brexit. I mean, for the longest time, it dominated news headlines, particularly when Theresa May was still Prime Minister. At this point, there's probably a more likelihood that I'll have a no deal at this point. Is Brexit still one of the things that concerns you guys as investors, or is it one of those that's sort of part of the, I suppose, risk elements when you look at the global news and the themes?
Well, time is rapidly running out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's 100 days or 99 days left for this to happen. I think one of the angles one might have is that with Juncker gone and with Theresa May gone, and Johnson, and I've forgotten the lady who's replaced Juncker, but there are new people talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
So, hope against hope, maybe there's a different angle or a different, or they can get a way to move beyond the impasse that is certainly happening at the moment, because a no deal would be bad, and the deal they've got is pretty bad as well. Mm. And as I said, they're running out of time. And one might say it's priced in, but the problem is we don't know what the effect is going to be, except for the fact that it's probably going to be bad if there's a hard exit. And we also know it's not going to be that great either, even if there is some kind of deal.
All right, cool. So let's get to the first question. This one's from Brett, and he wants to know whether the panel thinks Transaction Capital is a buy at these levels. Are there any red flags here? Jump here.
For me, the only red flag is valuation. It's got a very good management team, very good underlying businesses. SA Taxi is probably the best part of the business, especially the way they've integrated all the way through the value chain in terms of being able to also repossess the taxis that they finance, fix them, and resell them. And because it's a company with a great track record, a good management team, and good businesses, it's already in the price. At 17 Rand and less, you could have said there's value. But at 23, 24 Rand, for me, it's already discounting quite strong results that they'll probably deliver. Mm. But I would prefer a lower price to buy the share.
Rickus?
My sentiments exactly. I wouldn't want to add to that.
All right. So here's one that we talked about off air, which is a bit of a typical exam type question. So here the viewer wants to know, which between passive and active investing outperforms the other in a bull or bear market? Please support your answer.
Okay, if I may, I'll give an exam type answer.
Yes.
So those are relatively broad concepts, and I would say that therefore, when you talk about active and passive, we're going to talk about the average, or in statistical terms, the mean. Now, the mean has got a distribution around it, meaning that within that average, you have people who do a lot better and people who do a lot worse. You only get a distribution if you have a high enough population. Now, back in the day, passive just meant you track the shares based on market cap. These days, there are so many passive indices to track that passive itself has now got a distribution. And not all passive necessarily just tracks a market cap based index at a very low cost. Some passive funds are actually quite expensive. Mm. So what I would say is, in general terms, looking at the mean, passive outperforms active. Mm. It must be so because the population is so big that the difference between the two is costs. But within that, don't necessarily think that all passive outperforms all active.
Yeah.
Because in other parts of the distribution of this population, you have funds that are actively managed that generate a lot of positive or alpha returns. It has been the case for a long period. It is very difficult to identify those managers who can do that. Mm. But you can have a look at track records to see which ones sustainably have done so.
Rickus?
Yeah, I think one can actually broaden that question. One can obviously say, okay, active versus passive, and as you've said, the biggest determinant is cost, and your passive is generally will be lower than somebody actively managing that. But I think for an investor, one should always take into account that if you're investing on your own, it's a lonely business, whether you're active or passive. If things happen and you don't know why, and you can't pick up your phone and speak with a fund manager or with your portfolio manager, it's easy to make the wrong decision. So I'm obviously an active manager working with private clients, and as important as generating a reasonable return is helping, assisting the client to not feel lonely and help him make hopefully better decisions. And you're going to pay for that. But in the end, I think that's the value that can be added through active management.
All right. The next question says, should one start looking at REITs now or wait for a while?
So once again, there's a mean, there's the average, there's REITs, and then there are specific REITs. So in South Africa, we have a lot of REITs, real estate investment trusts, that invest in local properties, in retail, shopping centers, in offices, in industrial. And then we have a significant portion of our listed property market where the REITs actually have exposure to offshore properties in Eastern Europe, in the UK, and elsewhere. So within those different spheres, I quite like NEPI Rockcastle with their exposure to Eastern Europe and some of the other companies with exposure to Eastern Europe. I think the companies with exposure to the UK are probably the worst of the bunch in terms of how difficult the UK is. But the ones in South Africa specifically exposed to, I would say, office or second-tier retail, not strong retail nodes, but ones that have shown negative footfall growth and negative reversions and higher vacancies are in for a tough time as well. You can see that with some of the share prices, like Rebosis, Arrowhead, that's now going to merge with Gemgrow, Accelerate Properties, and a few others. So I would say be very cautious about the REIT sector. If you want some exposure, maybe consider the ones with Eastern Europe exposure, but I think there's some more pain to come for those ones with exposure to South Africa and the UK.
Certainly on the South African side, the retail section is under pressure. We had Massmart's results today, which were horrific. Now, if your retailer's not making money, you as the property owner is going to find it difficult adjusting your rental income from your clients. Yeah. So you might be looking at them, but from afar. And I would really like to see some type of economic growth before I'm interested in that local specific sector.
Let's stay with you for this one. The next question is from Leon, and he says, Woolworths is making new highs on the JSE. Should one buy?
That's interesting. I mean, certainly from their last set of results, it was less disastrous than the previous. Their problems in Australia is by no means over. So I think the price has recovered on the back of it's not that bad. I'm still worried as far as Australia is concerned that that's going to have a drag on what they are achieving at the moment with their South African operations. I think what I would like to see is a continuation of that recovery. I think the price has reacted on the results. I don't think the retail sector is a place to be in at the moment, so I wouldn't be surprised if it pulls back and there will be enough time to get into it as the next set of results and the one following comes through.
Jean-Pierre, do you share the same view?
In broad terms, yes. The key determinant is in Australia what's going to happen to the David Jones business, and it seems like that has found a base, and hopefully they'll create a destination now in the David Jones department store format for people to come and buy the luxury goods there, rather than competing with a more middle-income type product and their own label product, which hasn't quite worked in David Jones.
Yeah.
And then the South African business seems to be holding its own between food and clothing, some hits and misses. So I see value at this price, but it might be a while before we see the value come to the fore because you first need David Jones to contribute better to the overall profitability.
All right, let's take a break. And remember to keep sending through your questions via SMS to 41392 or email stockwatch@ddtv.co.za. Welcome back. Taking a look at the markets picture, starting off with things in the U.S. Stocks fall after Trump attacks China and that dampening hopes of a trade deal. Over in Europe, European stocks closed sharply lower on U.S.-China trade uncertainty and weak earnings. Still with me in studio are Jean-Pierre Frostaire from Protea Capital Management and Rikus Riedas from PSG Wealth Centen. So some of the questions that have come through have to deal with offshore investing. So we'll start with this one that came via SMS. Should I invest my discretionary savings in JSE stocks or place it in an offshore global equity feeder fund? My investment horizon is 7 to 10 years.
So there's not necessarily one that's better than the other. So we're following a theme here, where there are averages and then the real answers in the details, in the fat tails, as they say, of the distribution. So yes, you can make a decision of investing in the US or offshore, and using a feeder fund is an elegant way to do that because it means you just transfer your investment to a South African-based fund, mm-hmm. and that fund feeds it to an offshore fund. So you don't need to get exchange control approval or worry about things like that. It's a normal South African process. In terms of where the money ends up, you will either have a fund manager or portfolio with JSE stocks or one with offshore stocks, and the difference between the two is choice. On the JSE, you can choose roughly 400 stocks out of to build a portfolio. Internationally, you can choose, if you look at only 1 billion plus type market cap companies in developed markets, roughly 6,000.
Yeah.
So that does mean that you have more choice and that performance could be better, could be worse, and you have the added diversification of now investing in a foreign currency, which could do better or worse than the rand. Over the long term, 7+ years, I quite like to diversify. So I would like to have some exposure offshore rather than only have all my exposure to just the JSE.
Rikus?
I think if I can sort of lock on to what you were saying mm-hmm. about your separate population groups, I think a lot of, first of all, great, yeah, have some here, have some overseas, nothing wrong with geographic and currency diversification. But, you know, in as much as there's a difference between a mining company and a retailer in South Africa, there's a difference between globally going to the UK or going to the US or the Far East or wherever. And if one just takes a look at something like the MSCI World ETF, most of that or a large percentage of that is US funds at the moment. And for the very easy reason that the US has been growing, if you take a look at the indices, have been going up a lot. Therefore, it now forms a big part of any sort of global general fund. I think one should be careful to just say, well, let's go global. One should be very careful about which region, which country you go into, and get that asymmetry going again, not really not only chasing after the biggest, best-doing economy in the world. Take a look at things like the US. Take a look at emerging markets other than South Africa. Take a look at the Far East.
All right. The next question is from Alex, and he says he's interested in building a share portfolio, starting small with the following shares: Raynet, Master Drilling, and Investec. Please advise on the entry level for the above shares.
So it's never too late to start investing and start building a portfolio, but three stocks is not sufficient. That's not a portfolio. If you only have three stocks in your portfolio, you have a reasonable chance of doing a lot better than the market or a lot worse. And if you're starting as a novice investor, chances are it will end up being a lot worse. Mm. So it's difficult to start on day one with at least 10 shares, but it's more advisable to do that, to have at least 10 for diversification purposes. And between those three shares, I would just say that Master Drilling has got some challenges regarding their raise bore drilling technology and where we are in the CapEx cycle in the global mining industry, and it is a much smaller company than the other two. Raynet, with its look-through exposure to British American Tobacco and Pension Corp, looks good, but there's a big management fee that justifies a discount to the sum of the parts. It is trading at that discount, so it's already in the price, so that doesn't look too bad, and you get international diversification. And I'll leave the third one for Rikus.
No pressure.
Yeah, Investec. It's a company in transformation. I think we all know what it does over here. It's corporate finance, overseas asset management, that's trying to restructure. It's been doing it for a long time. So there's two problems. It's a company that is changing, and secondly, it's got a huge UK exposure, which is also a problem at the moment. So nothing intrinsically wrong with the company. I'm just wondering where the upside in the share price is going to come from. Mm-hmm. But as Jean-Pierre said, three companies is a start. You've got to start somewhere, but you have to realize that it shouldn't stop there. And a thing like Master Drilling is going to be interesting specifically if you're a novice investor, because it's cyclical and highly cyclical. And be prepared to make a loss there, but you're going to learn a lot about how the market moves. Raynet is pretty solid, you know, for tobacco and Pension Corp. And I'm not sure if I want to start something in the financial sector as well, because I think that's what he's doing. He's sort of doing a safe sort of British American Tobacco defensive type of thing, Master Drilling, which is highly cyclical, and then I've got to have a financial share as well. If that's the sort of idea that he's got, I don't know whether I would necessarily go for Investec.
Okay. The next question is from Martin, and he wants to know two questions, actually. Why has Mondi been suspended, and why has the CFD on Reinet been suspended by Standard Bank?
Okay. So in the case of Mondi, there were actually two companies, Mondi PLC, a British company, and Mondi Limited, a South African company. And they basically just reorganized where Mondi Limited, instead of being a dual-listed company, so two different shares listed, it became a subsidiary of Mondi PLC, and you got Mondi PLC shares in exchange for your Mondi Limited shares. So the two different companies, one domiciled in South Africa, one domiciled in the UK, effectively just merged.
Yeah.
As easy as that. In terms of why a certain bank would not write a certain CFD, those are normally the bank's own reasons for doing that. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, the other banks still write CFDs on Reinet. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why that has happened.
Okay. Ricus, do you want to take this one? It's on Aspen, and the viewer wants to know, how much further can Aspen's price fall, and should one consider buying it at these levels?
I don't know. I'm looking at this from a technical charting perspective, because I think we all know what the press is about Aspen. Huge amounts of debt, trying to settle that, and well, you can see from the share price, market doesn't like it at the moment. So I'm looking purely technical, and I think it was trying to hold on to that 100 rand level. It hasn't done it. It's probably going to retest its bottom, probably at about 80 or 75 rand. So until the fundamentals improve, I'm not really interested in investing it. As a trader, I'm not, unless I'm Jean-Pierre that can short things, I'm not going to try and pick a bottom on this one.
All right. Do you want to take?
Yeah, I'll do two quick sentences on Aspen.
Okay.
I would just say that as a general principle, when you add debt to a company's financial structure, you magnify its operational returns. Mm-hmm. So when things go well, they can look very well on a bottom line basis if you add a lot of debt. If things don't do well, it magnifies the downside as well. So in the case of Aspen, when things went well, debt helped them a lot because they never issued shares for acquisitions. When the operating performance slowed down, because of all the debt on the balance sheet from previous acquisitions, it magnified the downside as well. And we are still in that phase of their, you can call it corporate life cycle. And because the operational performance is under pressure, and we got news that Sanofi, who has a competitor product in Europe, is not doing well, people implied that therefore Aspen is not doing well in Europe, that means the operational performance might disappoint, and that magnifies the disappointment on the bottom line and puts pressure on the share price. So because of that sensitivity, the Aspen share price can go up a lot and go down a lot because of the existence of a lot of debt on their balance sheet.
Okay. Before we get to your stock picks, we've got a question on Long for Life. Is it a buy at current levels?
When you say at current levels, once again, I like the company. Yeah. Brian Joffe and a good executive management team. They've bought a few nice assets. But if I look at it, some of the parts basis, they need actually a higher share price to have an expensive currency to make acquisitions using their shares. Mm. And if their share price doesn't rise, they don't have that currency, and therefore their share price won't rise.
Yeah.
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, as George Soros calls it, a reflexive situation, where a lower share price begets a lower value, a higher share price has a higher value as a result, and because the share price is sort of languishing, they can't kickstart this motor and get this reflexive process going.
Okay, let's get to stock picks. Ricus?
Well, I'm stealing from you again, because what you said about debt and the way it gears a company. Anheuser-Busch, which is my stock pick, is a perfect example of that. Of a company that took on a lot of debt, and as a result, it didn't actually work out for it that well, and the price has dropped considerably. But with the last set of results, that debt situation, which they are servicing and can service, might actually work in their favor. And considering that they're probably at a 10, 15, 20% discount to similar operations globally, I think there's upside to that price, and it also gives me a sense of comfort in being pretty defensive, being in beer, in a market that is as volatile and a bit crazy as it is globally and also locally.
Okay, Rick is going on Anheuser-Busch. Yourself?
A US-listed company, Moody's. A lot of people would have heard of Moody's when they think about the credit rating of South Africa. Moody's is one of the largest credit rating agencies in the world, and they rate sovereigns, governments, they rate corporates, individual companies, and through these credit ratings that they issue, they get quite strong revenue. There's been a lot of credit issuance over the last decade. So they've issued a lot of credit ratings and made a lot of money. That seems to be continuing with low interest rates. A lot of companies are issuing debt as well as banks and governments, and therefore they need credit ratings and they pay Moody's. They had a bit of a wobble in 2008-2009, and people said that they were giving high credit ratings for very low quality debt instruments off the back of the US housing crisis, but that has sort of got out of the system. So at the moment, with a lot of debt that need a lot of ratings, my pick is Moody's.
All right, gentlemen, let's leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. We do have a lot of questions that have come through tonight, but for those that we don't get through, we will tackle them tomorrow. Thank you to my guests who joined us in studio, Jean-Pierre Forster from Protea Capital Management and Ricus Riedas from PSG Wealth Centre. We take more of your stock-related questions tomorrow night. Have a good evening. Let's get to stock picks, Ricus.
Well, I'm stealing from you again because what you said about debt and the way it gears a company. Anheuser-Busch, which is my stock pick, is a perfect example of that. Of a company that took on a lot of debt, and as a result, it didn't actually work out for it that well, and the price has dropped considerably. But with the last set of results, that debt situation, which they are servicing and can service, might actually work in their favor. And considering that they're probably at a 10, 15, 20% discount to similar operations globally, I think there's upside to that price, and it also gives me a sense of comfort in being pretty defensive, being in beer, in a market that is as volatile and a bit crazy as it is globally and also locally.
Okay, Rick is going at Anheuser-Busch. Yourself?
A US-listed company, Moody's. A lot of people would have heard of Moody's when they think about the credit rating of South Africa. Moody's is one of the largest credit rating agencies in the world, and they rate sovereigns, governments, they rate corporates, individual companies, and through these credit ratings that they issue, they get quite strong revenue. There's been a lot of credit issuance over the last decade, so they've issued a lot of credit ratings and made a lot of money. That seems to be continuing with low interest rates. A lot of companies are issuing debt as well as banks and governments, and therefore they need credit ratings and they pay Moody's. They had a bit of a wobble in 2008-2009, and people said that they were giving high credit ratings for very low quality debt instruments off the back of the US housing crisis, but that has sort of got out of the system. So at the moment, with a lot of debt that need a lot of ratings, my pick is Moody's.
All right, gentlemen, let's leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. We do have a lot of questions that have come through tonight, but for those that we don't get through, we will tackle them tomorrow. Thank you to my guests who joined us in studio, Jean-Pierre Forster from Protea Capital Management and Ricus Riedas from PSG Wealth Centre. We take more of your stock-related questions tomorrow night. Have a good evening.